Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Thank you all for joining us on this Friday afternoon and joining us live in an exclusive landmark TV innovator and groundbreaker, Norman Lear. Hello, Norman.
How you doing?
Very, very well.
Hello.
Thank you. We are delighted to have you with us.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Good.
And if you have a question or comment for Mr. Lear, give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number's good anyway, or catch us across the country, around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. And in order to get your calls in and as much time with Mr. Lear as possible, this half hour will be free of commercial and promotional interruption. Norman, when you look at the television landscape of now, what do you make of it, especially with all the scripted television that's happening?
Well, I tend to believe that now is the golden age. This is the moment. You know, there is the word over and next. Those are two little words we don't pay enough attention to. When something is over, it's over. We're on to next. If there was a hammock in the middle, that would mean by that living in the moment. So now, this moment, which took me all my life just to get to talk to you, Jason. Is it Jason?
Simon.
Hello. Simon Applebaum.
Yep.
And,
yep,
just to get to talk to you, it's taken every split second of my life for this. So how valuable is that? How important is that?
Well, for me, doubly very important. I've watched your programs all along, and do you ever connect the dots to say, like, if it wasn't for All in the Family, if it wasn't for Maude, if it wasn't for Good Times, if it wasn't for Mary Hartman, or all the Glitters and all the other shows you've done, that we wouldn't be at this moment, that we wouldn't be at a time when you have this variety of programming and unscripted with so much material and so many talents getting a shot, not only as you did to create and develop shows, but to run the shows?
It's hard for me to step back that far enough to make that observation. I think we were there stirring the pot along with a lot of other efforts, and that feels good to have been a part of it, as it does to be a part of this moment. And I think the best we can do is stir the pot.
Well, you're stirring it, I understand, because you're working with Netflix on reviving one of your creations one day at a time. Why did you decide to work with them about that?
Well, somebody came up with the thought, I think it was Netflix, somebody at Netflix, of doing a Latino version of One Day at a Time. So this is a Cuban-American family. And it's fascinating to deal with that. And Rita Moreno is just one of the great talents in the Western world. She plays the grandmother, Justina Machado, the daughter. And it's just fun dealing with something we haven't done before, which is a Cuban-American family. Mm-hmm. And we've got, you know, some great writers and showrunners and so forth. It's been a treat. We did 13. And they will be on the air starting 12:01 on a Monday morning across the globe on Netflix.
This coming Monday?
Oh, no, January 6th, Monday, January 6th. This coming Tuesday is mm-hmm. the documentary on my life called Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You. That'll be on PBS Tuesday night.
As part of their American Masters series. A lot of people, Norman, might be surprised to know, particularly people who think that your career started with All in the Family, to know that you were a major player with your first partner at All in the Family, Bud Yorkin, on shows like on Brian's show.
As a writing partner, earlier than Bud mm-hmm. Yorkin, my writing partner was Ed Simmons. So uh-huh. we did
and
Martin
and
Lewis.
Too.
Yeah, we did Martin and Lewis and the Martha Raye show and Ernie, Tennessee Ernie Ford. We did a lot of things together for a bunch of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we broke up, and then Bud Yorkin came into my life, and all of the rest of it we did together.
I want to ask you about that, but before that, the first show you actually created was a Western called The Deputy, which I believe was on NBC
yes.
for two seasons. Henry Fonda was the star. Alan Case was the deputy. And he did it with a man named Roland Cabee, who had also come out of variety and comedy shows. Later went on to do a little show with Robert Wagner called It Takes a Thief. I'm curious why the Western was the first time that you got involved in terms of creating a series.
Well, and it starred Henry Fonda, who was one of the great American stars at the time. The first great big motion picture star who came into television. It was a very early, early show. My biggest mentor as a writer, Roland Kibbe, had the idea. There was a major American play called Front Page by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur. And there was a gimmick in that show. It was about an editor who played all kinds of tricks on an investigative reporter that was threatening to leave all the time. He wanted to do something else. And the editor played trick after trick after trick on the guy to keep him working. And that's what Kibbe decided, let's do that with a Western and a sheriff and a deputy. And so Fonda played the sheriff that was trying to hold on with one trick after another to his deputy.
And it was a show that had sort of a very different feel from most Westerns at the time. It seemed there was a little more fun to the program, from the byplay that Fonda and Case had to the music by Jack Marshall, which was a guitar score, which was a very unusual situation at the time, as opposed to big, sweeping orchestra Americana. It just seemed to have a different flavor, a different type of style than what was on. And at a time when Westerns were the big thing in television.
Yes, it amazes me by how much history you have here. And nobody's ever talked to me about the deputy. I've been spending hundreds of hours between the book and the American Masters biograph. I can't tell you how many interviews I've done. Nobody's talked to me before about the deputy. I thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for the acknowledgement. I
and
really
you know,
that.
Here was the thing in the deputy that I so enjoyed when I ran the deputy again. This is a few years ago, but I'd forgotten about it. And the story in the first episode included the deputy had a gun store. And you see him alone in the gun store, and a guy comes in with a six shooter, takes it out of his holster. He said, this is shooting high and to the left. And the deputy, I forget, do you remember the actor's name?
Alan Case.
Who? Bill Conti? I forget his name. Anyway, the deputy says to the guy, I'm sorry, we don't do handguns, rifles only. And it was maybe among the first things I ever did, and there was a statement about guns. I got the biggest kick out of following that line of continuity.
A very unique line at the time. And incidentally, some of the episodes of The Deputy are available on YouTube, and I invite a lot of people, including our listeners, to check it out. It's a wonderful, wonderful series, and it was a great way to sort of bring your entrance into the world of creating and developing television. I have to ask about All the Family. When did you know that this program was going to strike a chord with all of us in America at the time?
You know, I don't really remember whether I understood at the time, but it would seem logical that when I made it originally in 1968 for ABC, But when ABC, when I sat with them and they looked at it and they roared with laughter, but they wouldn't put it on. When they asked me to do it a second time, and I did it a second time, same leads, word for word, the same script, two different younger people. And again, they laughed, but wouldn't put it on. They were afraid of it. It might have been then, or it should have been then, certainly, that I realized there was something. I knew it was funny because I saw it with people who were roaring, but that it was more important than just being funny. It had something to say. I can't actually say I remember feeling that, but I can look back now and say I should have.
One moment that I remember, I'm sure a lot of people do, and maybe one of the great classic moments without dialogue of all time, was the episode that Sammy Davis Jr. came to see Archie Bunker and his family, written by Bill Dana, directed brilliantly by John Rich, and the moment when Sammy Davis Jr. kisses Archie Bunker, played by Carol O'Connor, and the audience can't stop laughing. Was that planned? Was that in Bill Dana's script, or was that some of Sammy Davis had, in the spur of the moment, I'm going to do this?
No, that was Sammy Davis's idea. And we brought in the friend with the camera and created the moment, but it was his idea to do it. Maybe we had brought in the friend and the camera and to take a picture beforehand, but the kiss was strictly Sammy's idea.
And it caused not a stir, but I understand, like, the biggest laugh moment in the history, not just of that series, but maybe of all time, any comedy series. I understand that the audience couldn't stop laughing for, what, 2-3 minutes? And Marco Zappia, the videotape editor on the series, had to cut it down?
I don't know. It was a huge laugh. The whole script was wonderful, and Bill Dana was just great. Bill Dana, who wrote it, and we were great friends for a great long while.
And for those who don't know, he's still around.
For people who remember, who are listening, he was Jose Jimenez.
And he also, for about a year and a half, had his own television show, The Bill Dana Show, where he played Jose Jimenez on NBC. It was Sunday nights at 7 o'clock, 1964-65. And incidentally, those episodes are also now on YouTube. And they remain very, very funny.
My goodness, how great. Everything is on YouTube now.
It's become one of the great libraries of classic television. The shows you worked on, like the George Gobel Show, there's an episode of Martha Ray Show on. It's really become amazing how what started out as user-generated content has now become, among other things, this great repository of television's classic work.
I've got some time this afternoon. I'm going to spend it on YouTube looking for the things you're talking about.
You.
I wonder if I hosted Saturday Night Live in their early in their second season. I haven't seen that for 100 years. I got to see if I can find that.
Got to be somewhere. It has to be somewhere. When did you decide to let the producers of this American Masters special cover your work, cover your life and times?
Well, those people are two women, Rachel Grady and Heidi Ewing, and they're fabulous, just fabulous. They had done a couple of, several documentaries that I admired greatly, among them one called Jesus Camp, which is just a terrific documentary. And I was flattered that they wished to do it. And the understanding was that they would make it and I would have very little to say. I mean, basically nothing to say. If I had a good idea, of course they would listen. But they made it. It's their piece. And I think they did a glorious job.
And the range of people that they talked to, some of whom you worked with, like the co-star of Good Times, John Amos, Rob Reiner, your co-star, of course, on All in the Family, Russell Simmons, Phil Rosenthal, the co-creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, who was on our show several years ago when he had an HBO special about trying to sell that series to Russia, to the Soviet Union. Was there anybody that you were surprised was in the documentary talking about you?
No, Jerry Parencio, my long-term partner, and Alan Horn, you know, my great, great friend and a man who defines the word decent and now runs Disney under Bob Iger. George Clooney, whose first job in television I gave on a show called ER. We did a show, a comedy, a half-hour comedy starring Elliot Gould. And in an emergency room, it was called ERs. Most people don't know there were two ERs. That was the original, and Clooney played a small role in that.
Of all the shows you've done, is there any show that, given today's climate, you would love to bring back, that you would love to revive and give a second chance to?
The Powers That Be. The Powers That Be did not have a long life. It should have had a long life, but it was about Washington, D.C. I think it might have been the first show that dealt with Washington, D.C. And I think the network cast it because they thought it too savage. You know, the guy running for the presidency of the United States had a wife he wasn't sleeping with and a secretary he was. And he had no good sense at all. And he was gloriously played by John Forsythe. And that was a really rough look at Hollywood. I don't know, maybe there's something more satirical now, but it was as biting as could be at the time. And I think the network didn't let it go because it was Holland Taylor and John Forsythe and what's his name, Pierce. I mean, it was a great cast.
Pierce Brosnan from Remington Steele and James Bond. And
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I'm saying Pierce Brosnan, Remington Steele, James Bond. Is that the Pierce you were talking about?
I somehow didn't get that. Something about James Bond.
Right, I was thinking of Pierce Brosnan, who played James Bond, was in Remington Steele on television. I was wondering if that was the Pierce you were referring to.
The period I was referring to.
Ah, got it. Okay.
Norman, I don't know what happened.
So go ahead.
No, I was having difficulty hearing. It suddenly got very low.
Yeah, I apologize. I
am hearing you now.
Okay, great. Norman Lear is with us this half hour on a very special half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised. I'm Simon Applebaum, live in New York on Blog Talk Radio. If you have a question or comment for Mr. Lear, give us a ring. The number is 646-652-2906. And the documentary about him, the American Masters special, Just Another Version of You, happens this Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on PBS stations across the country. One of the things you did that a lot of other producers didn't do at the time, and we're talking about the early 1980s, was that you got involved with a local television series from WCBB in Boston called The Baxters. It was
one of the most unique formats ever. Yeah. Well, the Baxters, we did a short 8-10 minute scene about it was with a family, the Baxters, and they were having a problem. The problem could have been a social problem, an economic problem, a health problem. But then around the country, those stations, independent stations that picked up the show, had a host that followed our 10 minutes with a 20-minute discussion of the problem we illustrated. And in some places, it was a 40-minute. They did another half hour on top of it. And it was successful wherever there was a great host. It couldn't have been a more interesting attempt and innovative.
And the subject matter was quite diverse. You could go any which way with the show, and then the hosts on the local end, with their, some of which had a studio audience, like Channel 11 WPX here in New York, or other stations around the country, they could have a one-on-one interview, they could have a local studio audience, they could do polling. It was an amazing program for its time.
You know, as I hear you describe it, I wonder if it isn't time again to do that. It's a wonderful idea. And what I love about it is it generates conversation about subjects we need to be discussing.
Totally agree. We're going back, you know, mentioned going back to the thought of what you would like to bring back. I would love to see the Baxters get another try, especially in this age. There's so many subjects and so many issues that are on the minds of people that it might be time to bring that back in some way.
Well, this conversation, Simon, may have generated something. We shall see.
All right, great.
It's, you know,
and we are now here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Norman, and then we'll take a call.
Okay. I don't let somebody take the call. I don't want to interfere.
No. You're not interfering. Go ahead. You have a point. We want to hear it.
I was going to say, 6 years ago, I wrote a script about a retirement village, where people were in their 70s and 80s, but they were living on scooters and playing golf and having sex and getting married, and people were dying. And the show was called Guess Who Died? And recently, the New York Times, speaking of which you can find on YouTube, go to YouTube, the New York Times OpDoc. They have a series of OpDoc short films. They made one on me interviewing actors for the possibility of playing in a production of Guess Who Died. And it's only 7 minutes long, but it has sold the show. I can't talk about who has bought it, but we'll be doing Guess Who Died, a situation comedy about people in their late 60s, 70s, 80s, and above.
That's sensational, Norman. Congratulations. Looking forward to seeing it. Now we'll take that call. Hello, you're on Tomorrow Be Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, Simon. It's Rick Lab calling from Philadelphia.
Rick, go for it. You're on the line with Norman Lear.
Hello, Mike.
Hi, Norman. It's an honor to speak with you. Right now I'm taking a writing course with mostly adults. And I try and write more like situation comedies. So I'm wondering what your advice would be, especially for people who are adults, not youngsters, that are trying to write sitcoms today. Like, what kind of advice would you give us people, like, you know, older 30s, 40s, 50s, towards writing your sitcoms?
I would suggest to any writer, first of all, the best advice anybody ever gave a writer was write. A lot easier said than done, but write. And the second thing I would say is go with your gut. Your gut is telling you every minute what you wish to be saying. Say it. Go with your gut.
And do you think that do you believe nowadays it's necessary to live in Los Angeles in order to get a show on the air?
Well, it's as clear as it isn't necessary to live in Los Angeles. One can send in a great script, too, but one has to get it to somebody, to the right person to read it. And I guess one can do that in the mail or email. But in order to get somebody's attention today, I imagine one has to, well, it was true when I was trying to get attention. I had to get their attention. I'm reminded of the first thing Ed Simmons and I ever sold that caught some attention. The way I got it sold was I knew I wanted to write, it was something for Danny Thomas. How the hell do you get Danny Thomas on the phone when you're nobody? And I called his agent. I knew it to be William Morris' office. I called at noon, hoping that the agent would be out to lunch. The agent was out to lunch. I had the secretary talking as fast as I could. I said I was Norman Lear. I just spent 2 days with Danny Thomas. I'm writing for the New York Times. They're calling my plane. I have to write the article on the plane and file it when I get there. And she gave me his phone number. I had two questions I said I needed to ask him. When he heard, he picked up the phone when I called because he was working at home. And when he heard how I got his number, because he was surprised that a kid would be calling him, he was interested. He thought it funny, and he was interested in talking to me. Anyway, out of that conversation, we wrote a piece of material that we sold him that he was doing the next night, and 3 days later, we had an offer to come to New York and write a television show because he did it at a Friars event. There were a lot of agents there, and one agent called, and we were in New York writing a television show.
That's incredible. That's incredible and inspirational. And I'll definitely be looking out for Guess Who Died. So congratulations.
Good. Thank you for the call.
Absolutely. And thank you, Simon.
You're very welcome, Rick. Take care. Have a great weekend. Rick Bell, our friend from Philadelphia, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Norman, of all the actors that you worked with on all your various shows, who stood out for you as someone that was dependable, that surprised you with his or her performance, no matter what the show was?
Every great performance surprised me. You know, when you write something like Archie Bunker, yes, I wrote Archie Bunker. I can't tell you what I had in mind when I imagined how that would be done. I don't remember what... If I was writing something now, I would be going through the same thing. Carol O'Connor came in, read three lines, and he was Archie Bunker. I can't say that I imagined a Carol O'Connor in the role. I can say that I was attracted to that face. I didn't know who the name of the actor. He was in a Blake Edwards film, and I asked to meet him, but I couldn't imagine that he would become the Archie Bunker that we all know. Nor could I imagine an Edith, nor could I imagine Willa Maud. I imagined because I knew the actress very well, and you know the character was created for a talent I understood and knew. But when somebody comes in and takes your words and puts them on like a wardrobe, and suddenly you're so surprised to see the character created.
One other thing before we go, and that is another contribution that you made throughout your career was the gallery of women and women of color that you featured on your shows, whether it was dealing with Martha Ray back in the golden age of variety shows in the 50s, or Gene Stapleton and All in the Family, and and from the Jeffersons, and Esther All from Good Times, and B. Arthur from Maud, and Ruby Blaster, Mary Harmon, Mary Hartman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great gallery. When you think about it, it's like one of the greatest galleries of female comedic performances and talent that one person has ever been responsible for.
Well, thank you. And let me tell you, I am so impressed with your knowledge of the history of all of this and these shows and everything else. Most people who even occupy your kind of jobs are simply not historically as versed as you are, and it's a kick talking to you.
Thank you.
Take that, Simon.
I'm taking it. This has been a fantastic half hour. In 36 years of covering the world of television, to have the opportunity at last to interview someone whose work you have seen and admired and enjoyed, not just individually but with the rest of the American public for decades, and to see you and hear you 94 years incredible is one of the great honors of my life. And I cannot
and
thank you
can,
enough for
we can do it again Tuesday night, American Masters.
Absolutely. And
9 o'clock.
Also, yes, I want to say that too. The program is called Just Another Version of You. It's Tuesday night at 9:10 Eastern Pacific Time on your local PBS station. Check your local report. PBS is available in the area. Remember, some PBS stations may play the show earlier or later than Tuesday, and many PBS stations will replay it later in the week or on the weekend. And for more details online, pbs.org/American Masters. I've seen clips of the show, which, by the way, has been playing in theaters around the country for most of the spring and summer. It is dynamite. And one other thing, too. If you have not gotten this book, even this I Get to Experience, published by Penguin Press, hardcover or paperback, get it. It is an extraordinary volume to read. Norman, thank you so much for this half hour. It has been an honor to have you with us. And I promise you that when Netflix does One Day at a Time or your other show comes on, let's make this an hour show. We barely scratched the surface of what you've been doing for these many, many decades. And it's been an honor.
Simon, call me any time you have any question or idea. It was a delight being with you. Thanks.
You're welcome, Norman. All the best to you, your family, and friends. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Norman Lear joining us live this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. What an extraordinary human being. And to get that acknowledgement, no words, just thanks. When we come back here in New York, CNNNews.com senior writer Joan Saltzman will talk about TV tech from smart TVs to the possibility of virtual reality on the television set. And yes, we will talk about the possible breaking story that AT&T and Time Warner may merge. But first, let's pause quickly at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Welcome back to Tomorrow Be Televised on this Friday afternoon, 21st of October, 2016. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New Haven, New York. Delighted you are with us. We have some wonderful guests coming your way in the hour ahead, and we invite you to be part of the program. Give us a ring, 646-652-2906. That number's been anywhere. Catch us across the country, around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. And we finally have our chat room up and running. Simon Apple 04 by name. We had issues early on because of, in part because of the outage with Facebook, Twitter, other websites that's been happening throughout the day. But we want to welcome guests 1003 and 1018 in the room. Rick Weber, friends in Philadelphia. So now you can use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. You'll find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you can connect us with Facebook by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Tomorrow Be Televised is brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. More details later in the program. And now joining me here in New York, one of the top writers covering the world of the tech side of TV, specifically the digital side of TV, we're delighted to have back from CNNNews.com, Joan Saltzman. Joan, great to have you back.
Hey, Simon. It's good to be here.
And you're a big Norman Lear fan, I understand.
Well, of course. I mean, I was born in an age where I missed most of his contributions. I missed his most culturally significant kind of moments in American history. But I've seen him speak before, and obviously talking to you, it's him talking to you, that conversation. There was a lot of love shared. It's great to hear. I mean, he's a legend.
He's 94 years incredible. The man has been, as I mentioned at the top, as groundbreaking, as innovative a person as there ever been in this medium, and responsible for so much that we've enjoyed over the decades. And you can make the argument that it wasn't for All in the Family, if it wasn't for Good
right.
Times and Maude and so on, we would not have the kind of scripted television explosion that we had. He sort of took the brickbats as well as the praise for what he did, and look what we have now.
I know. I mean, I didn't live through it, but there's definitely touchstone moments from those programs that you can see would feel culturally relevant if it was something that aired today. You know, he was so unafraid, that should, especially All in the Family. That's the one I'm most familiar with, but was so unafraid to tackle issues that got under, you know, it picked off scabs and wasn't afraid to take on those sort of topics. That definitely makes it always feel like it's culturally relevant any time that you see it.
For sure. Well, right now what some people are dealing with are the reports that AT&T and Time Warner may merge. The Wall Street Journal today had the story that an announcement may be happening this weekend. David Faber from CNBC suggested that while the talks are on, they may not go anywhere. What's everybody's sense where you are about what's going on here?
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting that this went from kind of 0 to 90 in 12 hours. There was an initial report, I think, from Bloomberg that the talks were casual and, you know, kind of loosey-goosey, and Time Warner was open, would always be open to a great deal if it was presented, to the following morning when all of a sudden it sounds like AT&T, from the reporting, it sounds like AT&T wants to wrap this up as quickly as possible because of the prospect of a potential bidder like an Alphabet / Google or an Apple, which is, you know, unlike AT&T, they've got tons of money to just dump into anything that they wanted to go for.
And they want to get into content, and they've been sort of making all sorts of moves from the Audience Network that was a DirecTV feature. Now it's on DirecTV and Uverse, and they're up in the end in terms
right.
of the original shows they do there. There's also DirecTV Now that will be coming out soon. And they're working Gotter Media, Crunchyroll, Full Screen with their subscription video and man service available on smart TV sets and devices. One of the key executives at AT&T was here in New York at TV and Video Week for the next TV Summit, and he seemed to have no suggestion that this was happening. So that's why when the stories came out, it's like, whoa, what the magnitude of this, especially since Time Warner has been saying for a long time, you know, we have our hands full already with HBO and TNT and TBS and True TV and Warner Brothers, and we want to stay a content company.
Yeah, and Time Warner rebuffed the overtures from 21st Century Fox a year ago, right? It was last year that Rupert Murdoch's company tried to do the exact same thing that AT is trying to do now. And at that time, Time Warner said, we want to go it alone. There's more, we can create more value by being our own thing. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, what it always comes down to in deal making is the money, right? Like, everybody has their price, and if the price is high enough, then anybody would sell. But the question is whether or not AT&T, after buying, I mean, they bought DirecTV was a giant deal. After taking on all that kind of leverage, will they have it in their pockets to cough up enough to get? Is it going to be worth the amount they have to cough up to get Time Warner?
Let's move on to where we're at with smart TVs and devices like Apple TV and Amazon Fire and Roku and Chromecast, et cetera, et cetera. It's very clear that more than half the American public now has either a set or devices that allow them to watch Netflix and Hulu and Crackle and Amazon and Red Bull, who we're speaking with right after you today, as well as apps. I'll get to the Apple TV app situation in a moment. What's your sense of where this universe is at?
Well, it's really interesting how so many people, with the fact that, like you said, with so many people having either a smart TV to watch digital delivered content or a box like Roku or Apple TV to watch that through a different device, having that access starts to blur the lines between types of content, right? And a great example is Netflix and YouTube. Netflix is now on Comcast X1 boxes. And so Netflix is known for disrupting some of these, you know, the 22-second or the 22-minute sitcom format. When you aren't limited by commercial breaks, it's sitcoms or our dramas can be flexible with that. When you have a Netflix right next to your normal, quote-unquote, real TV content, and the consumer doesn't have any distinction between what is real TV versus what is digital TV, then it starts to change in the consumer's mind what TV should be. And so it's interesting to see where that's going to take the stuff that we watch, how the way that we get it is going to be changing the stuff that we watch.
Are the people like YouTube and Crackle and Hulu, et cetera, are they accepting that that's where a lot of people are watching their product? You get the sense Crackle is. You did an interview with one of the key people at Crackle, Eric Berger, at the New York Media Festival last month, and he suggested, yep, that's how they're doing it. Even Susan Wojcicki at YouTube at that brandcast back in May suggested, hey, more people are watching what we do on the TV set, and that may be why YouTube Red got going. Is there a sense among people that, in fact, that's how these services are being watched and used? And that's why we're seeing Netflix boost up the original programming it's doing, and Hulu and everyone else is trying to stay pace.
I think for each company, I think every company that's making a kind of visual media, whether it's a Crackle or a Netflix or a YouTube, it depends on their own individual circumstances. So Netflix and YouTube are good examples because they're very different. So Netflix is focused on that sort of high-quality, premium, long-form content that works best on a television, and as a result, the majority of people, the majority of their viewing is on actual TVs versus YouTube, which has come out of this sort of foundation of, as you said earlier, it's a user-generated background. Its stuff is it's shorter and sometimes gets denigrated as being lower quality, but there's a lot of very kind of high production value stuff that's coming onto YouTube to address that giant audience there. Tons of their viewing is on mobile. And so I think what both of those companies are going to be doing is they're slowly trying to adopt the markers of what the other is doing. You know what I mean? So YouTube is making content that has higher budgets, more clean production values, and Netflix is starting to venture into YouTube territory. They have a new series from Miranda Sings, which is a YouTuber star. So they're both kind of, I think what everyone's trying to do is to cover all their bases. And in today's environment, that means you need to have snackable content. You need to have long-form content. You need to have stuff that looks really, really good. And you can also have stuff that hits the right mark, even if it's shaky and made off the cuff.
We're speaking with Joan Goldman. She is the super senior writer of all things digital and media, too, at CNetNews.com. Great source for tech news, all sorts of it. And she joins me live here in New York this half hour. On Tomorrow will be televised. Simon Applebaum here with you live on Blog Talk Radio. Glad you could be with us on this Friday afternoon. You have a question or comment for Joan? Don't be shy. Raise the voice. Use this number, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We welcome guest 1061 into the room. We have 3 episodes coming your way next Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And coming up on Monday, we got another big exclusive for you. We will have the commissioner of the New York City Office of Media Entertainment, Julie Menn, will join us in a very rare live radio interview. We'll talk to her about the new efforts that the department is doing to elevate more diversity among women and people of color in television, including the Made in New York Writers Room and a new women's initiative that has several parts to it, including maybe an opportunity for women TV makers to meet with venture capitalists, angel investors, incubators, and get their work going. It's Julie Menn, Monday, 3 or 3:30 Eastern, noon or 12:30 Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Televised. I have a special Wednesday edition for you, and on the program we've got the creator, producer, and writer of the new IFC comedy with John F. McGinley, Stand Against Evil. Think of it as the comedic Walking Dead. Dana Gould will join us. And from the series that used to be on Showtime and is coming to Nat Geographic Channel, the Emmy-winning Years of Living Dangerously, executive producer David Gelber. That's all coming up Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Joan, it was over a year ago that Tim Cook at the Apple TV event in San Francisco declared the future of TV is apt. A year later, we have 7,000 apps on Apple TV. You can now order a pizza through Papa John's. You can now order tickets through StubHub. Twitter is now a feature for the last couple of weeks. What's your sense of where Apple TV is at now with 7,000 apps on it?
That's a really good question. I would be interested to know who are the people that are ordering pizza from Papa John's on their Apple TV. Have you ever ordered a pizza through your Apple TV, Simon?
Not yet.
Okay. I haven't either. I haven't either. And I think that when we talk about Apple and Apple TV and the future of TV as Apple, I think that the emphasis should be on the TV part of the future of TV is apps and not the apps part. You know, I think that a television is a really great device for content, and it might be easy to get distracted by the sort of unconventional integrations that it has. But I'd be surprised to know who are those people that are using it for those things that seem unconventional for television, because television is a really good thing at delivering television to people. But I think that that the movement that, like, traditional TV companies are going in towards a more app-like environment, you know, Comcast with X1, that's a platform where it's not quite like apps, but there are integrations between, and on Dish too, where there's integrations not just with your regular TV programming, but also with Netflix and with Weather Channel and with YouTube. Being able to have those things in the same place, it's not quite as App Store-like as Apple TV makes it, but people are going in that direction because people are used to their phones. Their phone is their primary screen nowadays, and that interaction is what they are expecting in all their other kind of screens.
It's interesting, though, that we're seeing, for example, a way using Apple TV and also Amazon Fire to do things like use Airbnb, where you see some of the apartments that Airbnb players are in, or Zillow, the homes that are up. We understand Home Advisor may give you like a sense of, here are some of the people that could help you with your plumbing or whatever you're dealing with your screwing up your home or apartment, and then use the app to call somebody to come over to your house and fix it, or to order merchandise, transact from a place like Guilt Group, or to see the pizzas that you can order from Papa John and maybe the daily specials and then order and have it delivered. The thing that's curious, though, Joan, is that it seems that Apple TV and to some extent some of these other players like Roku and Chromecast, when they could have opportunities to showcase themselves, they don't. Great example, the latest Apple special event in San Francisco, where obviously a lot of those go to iPhone 7, and yes, there was stuff on Apple Music and a half on Apple Watch. And you would think that Tim Cook or Eddie Q, the Apple executive who oversees Apple TV, would take some time and say, here's what Apple TV is up to, especially
right.
at like a one-year anniversary. Nothing. And Apple TV is yet to, you know, do events here in New York or around the country where they bring the apps and the press together and say, here's what's going on.
There is an opportunity for Apple to do that next week. Apple's going to have an event on Thursday. It's traditionally Apple has a September event where they unveil the iPhone and kind of as a sideshow what other things kind of are most relevant to that, so like Apple Watch, things like that. But they also traditionally also have an October event, and that's going to be next week on Thursday. It's anticipated that is going to focus on Macs, but there's also, you know, kind of an expectation that Apple TV is going to get some prime time as well. So we might see Apple TV get to have an appearance on that splashy Apple stage before the year's out.
Before we get out of it, though, we saw a new player jump in to a lot of different fields, including the smart TV set, and that's LeEco, L-E-E-C-O. Two words, sounds French or Spanish, but they're China's largest, or one of the largest manufacturers of consumer electronics in China, who bought Vizio. I think the deal has not gone through yet, but they bought Vizio several months ago. They had a big splash in San Francisco. 700 press people came, and they seemed to create this whole ecosystem of, here's our smart TV, here's our VR, virtual reality headset, and such and such. And it was interesting to read the coverage from your organization and others that it was sort of mixed around the board. What was the sense of people to LeEco getting into this field, the U.S.?
Well, I think LeEco is very confusing to a lot of people, including the people that know what it is and went to that event. It was very baffling because it involved, I mean, they unveiled phones, a car, a VR headset. They talked about having a streaming service, a mall, and also everything is called Le something. So they have Le Mall, Le Rewards, they have a bike. I mean, it's just so much. And to people in the U.S., people that are probably listening to your show, it can be confusing because it feels like a mishmash of things that you can't actually see in person if you want to try them and buy them. You have to buy them online. And so it faces two kind of hindrances to making a splash here. One, you have to buy these things online. You can't, you know, you have to buy them sight unseen, basically, even if they do have really great deals, like an 85-inch television for $5,000. Two, these are things, they're doing things that other giant companies have been doing in the U.S. for years. Like, they're one of China's most powerful streaming services in China, but in the U.S., we have Netflix. They are a big maker of handsets, but we already have, I mean, everybody already has iPhones. So they're coming into a saturated market without being able to let people feel and touch and start to gain some trust in what the products are.
And they also have a production company. They want to do content here in the United States, a company called LeVision. They hired Adam Goodman, a former key executive at Paramount Pictures. It sounds like they will do television as well as movies. I would think they'd get into the scripted series business, since everybody is. So it seems that they want to be your content, your tech, your everything.
Yeah, that's the idea. LeEco means La in Chinese means happy, and Echo is short for ecosystem. So the idea is that they're creating an ecosystem of content and products and services that when you step inside the Echo universe, it meets all of your needs. I talked to Adam last week before the this week before the event. And you're right, they, in addition to all these other things that L'Echo does, they're the third biggest film producer in China. So it sounds like what Adam and his group is going to be focusing on at first is kind of traditional theatrical film releases. The thing that makes it different is they, at least allegedly, he says, they don't have to worry about blockbusters. They don't have to worry about box office because they'll find other ways to make their productions profitable by being part of a tech company. So it's going to be fascinating to see what the heck happens with all these tentacles that L'Echo is trying to extend into the U.S.
And they're going to have an event here in New York where they show off that ecosystem. It'll be second week of November, and we are going to try to be there.
I'll see you there. I'm
going to
go there too. I'll see you. We'll see each other.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward, and I hope Adam shows up. I'd like to hear from him whether they do want to get into scripted TV or unscripted,
yeah,
and how big a thing they see TV in the next. They didn't make that clear.
I think they probably will. They have to, right? Yeah. I mean, everybody has to be doing everything. You can't just do 90 minutes anymore. You have to do 90 minutes and 90 seconds.
No, absolutely. In fact, yesterday we heard from Olympusat at the Hispanic TV Summit here in New York, and in one sense, the CEO, Tom Mueller, threw a bombshell, sort of a Netflix-like movement, that next year they want to create, get this, 120 original made-for-TV movies in Spanish, and 10 at least scripted series, 26 episodes each, where they would produce some in the United States, some in Mexico, some in the Caribbean. More details to come. And he sort of like did it very nonchalantly, like, I'm looking in the audience like, what? You know, Netflix move. You know, it's like they want to be, if they would be on Netflix, the biggest original Spanish language program in the world. 120 made for TV movies.
Right.
All the best to Tom. I know Tom. He can. We'll see if he can do it. Another big subject at NYC TV and Video Week, fourth annual edition, wrapped up yesterday, was the virtual reality conference that they did on Monday. The sense seems to be that the chips are going from whoever's playing on headsets, headgear, goggles, Google Cardboard, Google Daydream, and mobile phones. And very few people are looking at doing virtual reality on the television set. But we know two things. One, Apple TV has a project called Little Star. They've been around for nearly a year. We've had them on this program, same move with the CEO, where you don't need goggles, glasses. You take your Apple TV remote or Siri, your voice control, and you manipulate the picture any way you want. They're aggregating content. But you and I at the New York Media Festival had this demonstration from Lockheed Martin called Field Trip to Mars, where kids on a school bus, as they're going to a destination, see out the window what was the road that they're traveling on morph into the surface of Mars. And they don't use goggles or glasses or headgear. It's just their own two eyes. So you wonder, what kind of thinking is there now about, you know, this idea of headgear, et cetera? Is it versus the TV set? Is it, are people looking at playing both sides and trying to maximize the audience? How do you see the dialogue going?
Well, I think that there's definitely a lot of focus on headsets right now for just the simple reason that there are tech giants that are just pouring billions of dollars into that quote unquote form factor. You know, that headset based way of experiencing VR is getting, you know, Facebook bought Oculus for $2 billion, and they're spending another $1 billion on content last year and this year and next year. That's just Facebook alone. So it makes sense that a lot of the attention and a lot of the creativity is going to be happening for that sort of device right now. But the Field Trip to Mars is a great example of how virtual reality can be something much more broadly experienced than just on a headset. That bus with the glass windows that can shift from being transparent into screens just kind of goes to show that when people start to, and I think that what's going to happen is that people are going to get accustomed to VR through the headsets, whichever one ends up being the leader, and we can talk about our bets on which one's going to be the one that kind of takes the first place of the race so far. That's going to get people interested in the idea that VR can be an exciting way to entertain themselves. And I think after that is when we're going to start to see things like Field Trip to Mars become more of a consumer proposition, or where theaters, cinemas, and theater chains start expanding, like maybe one theater becomes a group VR experience. Because the form factor of the headset is already sort of set as the first wave that gets people into the idea of how VR can be something that they enjoy, that's probably going to dominate for a while, but, you know, there's lots of possibilities.
It did mean, though, that some of the key players can go both ways. Google, for example, has Daydream and Cardboard, which are impressive, but they also now have 30 million users of Chromecast. And incidentally, Anit Singh, who is one of the key Google executives, who spoke on Monday at this conference in New York, at the New York Times Center, I asked him, hey, you have 30 million Chromecast users. Are you looking at putting Chromecast, make that a way for people TV on the TV? And he said, yes, we are looking at it. You have a hunch that Google can make it go, that all the other key devices and the smart TV set makers, Samsung being one, who is placing their chip on headsets, and so forth, that and the VCs at Echo does that too, because they're coming out with a VR headset, but they also make smart TVs. So VCC, if somebody can make it work on the TV set, do we have people rush in? Do we have people say wait and see if the audience show, if the mass shows up, or something else happens?
Well, I think what's going to be, if there's going to be kind of breakthrough marriage for television, the television set and a kind of virtual reality technology, it's actually going to be, I think augmented reality has more of an advantage working with the television. So for people who don't know, virtual reality is where you put something, usually you put something over your eyes and it makes you feel like you're in a entirely different place. Augmented reality is where you can still see the world around you, but it adds digital overlays on top of it. So maybe you're looking at a table and you can build a Minecraft creation on that table, or all of a sudden like R2-D2 and C-3PO walk in through a door and they have a conversation with you. Augmented reality, because of the fact that you're still looking at the world around you, you could be looking at a TV, and with some sort of augmented reality integration, maybe if Microsoft were to do it or if Magic Leap were to do it, you could be watching a program and that program could start to come into your own room and be there with you from the television that you already own. There's a lot more possibility with augmented reality because it lets you see what's already there. So if you have a television, there's no reason why you couldn't bring that television content, that programming into your life if you had the right tech.
Yeah. And thank you, by the way, for the definitions of augmented reality versus compared to virtual reality, because some people confuse the two. And that was, by the way, a very big point. A lot of, to their credit, a lot of the speakers on Monday at this conference made was the differentiation point of augmented reality and virtual reality. Personally, I think both ways can win. You just would like to see more effort on the television side as much as on the gear side. So I'm not taking sides. I've seen both. I've worked with both, and they're both very, very impressive. Before I let you go, Joan, is there a company working in television, a tech company in TV, that let's exchange thoughts here. Let's say we'll come forward the last 2 months of the year and we should keep our eyes on.
You mean it's going to have like a big announcement or something like that?
Yeah, a big announcement or something we don't know about that's going to break through. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's putting me way too much on the spot. I don't know about before the end of this year. I don't know. Well, I'm going to put it to you. Answer first? Can you answer that?
Right. I'll go for it, yeah. There's a company called Interlude, now known as Echo, EKO. It's a company that has funding from MGM, from Sony, has VC and angel-invested funding. They're trying to put interactive programming of a choose-your-adventure type together. I just checked on their website yesterday. They're working on two television series. One that we reported on as a news note a few months ago was bringing back the Twilight Zone, where at various parts in the show, you can determine either using your tablet, your smartphone, your remote control, maybe even your voice control. For those who don't know, Amazon Fire TV now has Alexa in their product. You can use the voice control for that. You can control where the plot goes. And they're also working on a TV series version of War Games, the MGM movie with Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy. So I think keep your eye on them. I think they're going to announce themselves. I checked the website out, but I think they're going to announce themselves at the end of the year and finally make a move.
Interlude's a really interesting company for sure. And they, having kind of working on their side is the fact that they have been working not only with people like with the War Games series, like working on pure content, pure storytelling narrative stuff. But they've got a really great brand business where they make interactive videos for companies. And so they've already got built in like a way to make money, which is so rare among content startups, interactive digital content startups, which gives them a lot of power too.
And one more thing, going back to, again, Echo and what they're going to do here in New York, I would love to see Apple and Amazon and Roku do press events in New York where they bring the app developers in so that we can see these apps and we can see the latest channels and so forth and content and tech that these devices are doing. And maybe Echo doing it in a couple of weeks may force Amazon and Apple. Amazon and Fire TV is getting very interesting because they are also now offering Twitter. They're offering Orbit. They're offering, and it'll be interesting to see whether at some point Amazon offers their merchandise, their entire catalog of products at some point. So I got to think that's their holy grail, is to offer through the television set their products.
Yeah. Well, we have a lab in CNET, so if you ever want to come visit us and play around with things, it's not quite getting a press event from the companies themselves, but you can borrow our lab. I can give you a little tour.
All right. Love it. Love it. Love to do it. You got a date. If you want to catch Joan's work, go to news.com. It's a wonderful website. Joan writes great for it. So does her colleagues. And check it out. CNETnews.com. 24/7. Great, great tech news. Joan, thank you again. It's been a pleasure. Let's do this again soon. I'll see you in a couple weeks for the Echo Ecosystem here in New York.
Thanks, Simon. Great to be here.
You too. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care. Joan Sovman from CNNnews.com joining us live from New York. More of Tomorrow's Channel Live coming your way after the top of the hour, after we pause for some messages from the fine folks at Audible.com. Are you a Breaking Bad fan? You like the work of Bryan Cranston? Well, he's got a brand new book and audiobook out, and you can catch it at Audible.com. It's called The Light in Part. Read it at a bookstore at Penn Station, and it is marvelous about his incredible career. Another book you might want to look at or hear is Phil Collins' new tome, Not Dead Yet. Two great audiobooks for you, and they are now available through Audible.com. Audible.com is a leading provider of spoken digital entertainment and information. Over 180,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. So remember, if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, it's audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service. And the service, because Audible is an Amazon company, is top of the universe. So check out what Audible can be for you. Give you a sensational sound experience 24/7. AudibleTrial.com/televised. AudibleTrial.com/televised. Audible Trial, an Amazon company. We come back. Josh Cole, the executive producer of Red Bull TV's new series, The Horn, will join us live from California IA. But first, at the top of the hour, we pause for web identification. You are catching the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, more than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for We Talk Radio, the hip-hop scene. Comes your way less than an hour from now, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. That's VTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the Lobby Televised. Welcome to those of you who joined us at the top of the hour. And we're welcoming in right now from IRL, California, the executive producer of the new TV series on Red Bull Television, The Horn, Josh Cole. Josh, great to have you aboard.
Hey, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about The Horn. The Horn in reference to the Matterhorn, but not just the Matterhorn, but that whole wide world that this show deals with.
Yeah, absolutely. The Horn is a title that refers obviously to the Matterhorn. Horn in Swiss German, in German is peak. Matter is meadow. So it's the horn of the meadow, the peak of the meadow. But the horn itself in this series is also a reference to the alarm that sounded when our helicopter search and rescue operation Air Zermatt needs to go into action and save somebody from a potentially very perilous or life-threatening situation up there in the Swiss Alps.
And your question coming for Josh, give us a ring, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You catch us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio. We've got our chat room functioning. Simon Apple 04 by name. You can find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. We have guests 1061 and Rick Rowe, my friend from Philadelphia, who called up while Nolan Lear was on the air last hour. He's in the room as well. So be in the room, be on the phone. Either way, we will hear you. And again, while the program is on the air, you can connect with others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Josh, how long has Red Bull been looking at doing a program like this?
Well, they've been discussing the idea of getting into more of a kind of broader reaching, unscripted television slash documentary style of production for a while now. I've only been with the company myself for a year, but you know, this has been in development probably for at least the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, they've been ramping it up, kind of figuring out how to get their feet into, you know, more traditional long-form documentary subjects that aren't exclusively centered on what people know of as the Red Bull brand, which is action sports and music content. And so this was one of their first efforts to kind of bridge that gap and get into something that still lives in their adjacent world. You know, it's in the mountains, there's snow, but we're not following snowboarders having adventures. We're following a search and rescue team as they kind of approach life and death situations with the pragmatism that only the Swiss are capable of.
Did it call for a whole different way to approach doing this, unlike, let's say, other shows that Red Bull does or anybody does, which are extreme sports, action sports in nature? Because you're talking about having to deal with rescue teams in dire circumstances. You can't, you know, script what's going to happen. And obviously, when you're dealing with locations like the Matterhorn, it's a danger not just for them, but for your crew.
Absolutely. You know, I've worked in a lot of different environments myself throughout my career, and I've worked in, you know, on programs that also are documenting life and death situations in other environments. And so that kind of came into play a little bit. But, you know, to answer your question a little more directly, we had you know, a decent amount of lead time to prepare for this. And the idea was that we wanted to be able to serve as observers to the work that these people do. We didn't want to create any problems for them, and we didn't want to get in their way. We didn't want to, you know, in any way hinder the operations that they need to engage in. And that was one of the first prerequisites of this project, was to make sure that we would be able to tell good stories without having any impact on the work that these guys do. And obviously it's impossible to have zero impact, but what we were able to do was work very closely with the Ayr Zermatt executive board, particularly Sam Sumermatter, who is their lead pilot, but also on the executive board, to make sure that we were operating in a way that they were comfortable with. And, you know, one of the things that allows us to do this sort of storytelling right now is the technology that has come out in the last 5 years or so. And that's the kind of body worn action cameras like GoPro and things like that. And we used GoPros extensively on this show. It was important to me that we have a cinematic look to the series as well. So we shot things beautifully with, you know, with long lenses and things that you would not necessarily think of in a sort of action follow documentary style. But we also were using the GoPros in every circumstance. I mean, they were worn on people descending into crevasses to save skiers who had fallen 100 feet underneath the surface of the snow. They were attached to every interior and exterior part of the helicopter you could imagine to capture the adventure.
So there's a lot of virtual, you are there, we're talking about virtual reality on the last half hour with Joan Solson, CNetNews.com, a lot of virtual reality, you are there feeling. Are these GoPro cameras, body cameras, easy to use? Are they very flexible?
They're fairly user-friendly. I mean, they come, we were using the model that is now the previous model, because the new one just came out, the 5. But we were on the 4, and it is, you know, with the casing that they come with, they're water resistant, waterproof, you know, to a certain extent. And once you turn them on, get them set, make sure that you have the settings appropriately rigged up, and you've got good enough battery and good enough card space, they can go for hours. And, you know, you're obviously not a camera operator, and as a director, it's hard to let go of the control of what you're looking at. But there are situations where you cannot otherwise be there. And so we are allowing the audience an opportunity to really see things that nobody's ever seen. I mean, even the guys who work at Ayr Zermatt were blown away by some of the stuff they saw. And in particular, in our first episode, Simon, who is our one of our mountain rescue specialists, descends into a crevasse to save a skier. And He has a camera, a GoPro attached to his chest. And the guys who fly these rescue missions and the paramedics, they don't go down into these holes, you know, and they don't know what it's like for Simon. And this was their first opportunity to really see what it's like for him when he drops down in there and sees somebody who is in a very, we'll call it a near-death state.
The Horn premiered earlier this week on Red Bull TV. That is the channel that's available 24/7 on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. We're talking with Josh Cole. He's executive producer for Red Bull TV and especially for this series. He joins us live from Idaho, California, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Applebaum will be with you from the other coast, Nueva York specifically. 66 degrees at the top of the hour here in Nueva York. You have a question or comment for Josh? Don't be shy. Ring the phone at 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Got three episodes more coming your way next week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Our Monday episode maybe is 3:30 Eastern, 12:30 Pacific. We'll keep you posted through Facebook and other social media. But next Friday, we will be at our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. And joining us first will be the creator and co-executive producer of the new TBS comedy, People of Earth, also executive produced by Conan O'Brien. His name is David Jenkins, a new talent to watch. I've seen clips of People of Earth. I think this will be a big breakout show for TBS. And then we'll have another interesting service that's available on smart TVs and smart TV devices. It's called Rooster Teeth. And we'll have the head of programming there, Evan Bergman. That's all coming up Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Josh, did this rescue squad find you or did you find them?
It was a little bit of a combination, actually. We, our development, our head of development in the U.S., J.T. Latt, who was formerly at National Geographic Channel, reached out to a developer, a producer, who is an acquaintance of his, who works out of Los Angeles, named Rob Hill, with a company called Punchdrunk Pictures, and said, "Hey, Rob, we're looking for the best helicopter search and rescue operation in the world." And Rob said, okay, and reached out to people he knew all around the world. And through a network of acquaintances, the word got to Sam at the Air Zermatt base. And Sam thought about it a little bit and then reached out to Rob, and the ball started rolling from there. So it was a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm. And how often does the squad go on the missions they do?
They do about 1,700 rescues a year. So, you know, if you do the math on that, they average, I don't know, 5+ rescues a day. And they're busy. I mean, the rescues range in scope dramatically. I mean, it's everything from a broken ankle to somebody who's buried in an avalanche. So some of them are a little bit less dramatic and compelling, I guess you would say. But they are constantly working, constantly flying and ready 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to handle whatever comes their way.
What kind of rescues did you and your crew go on? Give us a sense of the range of situations.
We saw it all. I mean, we were there during the winter season, so there were certain things that they do that we did not see. For example, in the summer, they also work in firefighting operations. They'll pull cars and motorcycles out of canyons as people have driven through the mountain passes that are closed in the winter. You know, mountain biking accidents, people doing more paragliding and things like that. That's the summertime operation, and we were not there during the summer. We filmed their winter operations. And, I mean, we saw everything from, you know, somebody having altitude sickness and just needing to get a flight down to the hospital to get hydrated and reset, to, you know, extracting a skier, a snowboarder out of a crevasse that was literally 100 feet deep. I mean, they had just fallen 100 feet from skiing on the top of the snow into just an icy hole. And, you know, we also were able to be on the scene for some avalanche rescues, some other situations where people have fallen off of cliffs and things like that. So, I mean, it was a real adventure for our crew, and it was a wonderful opportunity to be able to be close to these guys who do such great work and have a passion for the work that they do out there.
How did you arrange the episodes? Was it covering a particular incident per episode, or did you try to mix it up? Like a show like Cops, where, for example, you will see like three or four different situations in a half hour or an hour.
Well, one of the real exciting things about this project and working with Red Bull on it was that I had the freedom to structure things however I liked, to a certain extent, as long as people seemed to agree with me after a while. You know, there was no format that we followed. We let the content dictate the structure of the show, which in unscripted television is something that you probably are aware is completely abnormal. So it was something that was really exciting from the beginning. And what we did was, you know, I discussed with the other producers that I was working with on the project, the ideas that I had, not knowing what we would capture, not knowing what rescues we would get, not knowing what types of stories we would experience while we were out there, the themes that I thought were relevant after talking with these guys out there, you know, the theme of man's relationship with nature, you know, the human relationship with the environment and how they work in concert and in opposition to one another. And I felt like that was a theme that we could explore and could be something that we would be able to, you know, arrange experiences around. And there were other themes that we thought about as well, about the idea of always pushing forward, always looking to the future, which is something that this company prides itself on, not just Red Bull, but Ayers Rahmat as well, is always looking to try to advance their techniques and their technology. And that's one of the founding principles of their company. And so that idea was one that we thought would be an appropriate concept for an episode. We also thought that the idea of death was one that we would like to pursue as a potential theme to explore, because you can't avoid it. In an environment like this and with the work that these guys do, not everybody survives. And we ended up kind of changing the approach to that as we began to see what stories were coming in. But there was so much, it's such a rich environment. I mean, we knew going in that it was going to be beautiful. There was no doubt that we were going to film beautiful things, because it's one of the most astonishingly mind-blowing regions of the world topographically. I mean, those mountains are a scale that you just can't understand until you see them in person. And so we knew that we had that going for us. And we knew that there would be compelling human drama, because that's what these guys work in. You know, they work in an environment where people need help, and they're there to provide that help. But our challenge was to really figure out how we could tell good stories and how we could approach this in a way that is unexpected and is beyond the ordinary, because there are helicopter rescue shows that are on cable, and they're fine. They do what they're supposed to do. But what we wanted to do was to make sure that there was absolutely no exaggeration in our storytelling. There was no hyperbole. There's no sensationalism. I mean, these people do a job, and they do it every day, and they approach it with calm, and they're deliberate in their work. And one of the things that I said to the director of photography when we first got out there was, we should not be shooting this frantically. They're going to work deliberately, or they're not doing their job well, and we should work deliberately too. We need to make sure that we are telling the story of the experience that these people have. And I'm so proud of the work that everybody did on this show, because it translates. And you know, if you sit down and watch it, you feel like you're there. You understand what it means to be a part of this experience.
We're speaking with Josh Carl. He's the executive producer of the new Red Bull television series, The Horn. And if you have a smart TV set, or a smart TV device like Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Chromecast, NVIDIA Shield, et cetera, chances are you can get Red Bull TV 24/7. Josh joins us live from Idlewild, California, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. I'm Applebaum here with you live from New Weber, New York. Delighted you're with us this Friday afternoon. If you have a question or comment, not too late to be involved, so give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. And coming up on Monday's program, we'll have another live exclusive interview with the commissioner of the New York City Office of Media Entertainment, Julie Menon. It's one of her first interviews on live radio since she took the job about 5-6 months ago, and we'll get her thoughts about expanding diversity among women and women and people of color in the television field, including a very interesting project that just got underway a few weeks ago called the Made in New York Writers Room. Wait to hear about it. If you know people who want to get into television based in New York, you might want to have them tune in. Julie Menon of the Office of Media Entertainment here in New York. That's Monday, 3:30 p.m. Eastern, 12:30 Pacific, right here on tomorrow will be televised. Josh, in one of the press releases Red Bull came out with promoting the horn, you were quoted saying that you wanted this series to be a meditation of what it is to be human. How do you communicate that ideal?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. I mean, that was one of my thoughts going into this show before we even had any idea who was going to be filming it, how we were going to be out there, what types of equipment we would have, and really before we knew the characters. We had met them, we had filmed with them briefly to put together a, you know, kind of a concept and mood piece, but we didn't have any real long-standing relationships with them, so we didn't really understand who they were. But it seemed to me that because we were working in an environment where there was this struggle between survival and death, that we would have opportunities to approach the ideas that sort of define people, that define us as we interact with our environment and with each other. Because the people who are operating in these helicopters at high altitude and in these crevasses and digging people out from avalanches, they're not doing this to be famous. They're not doing this to be rich. They're not doing this to get a pat on the back or a cookie. They're doing this because they have no choice. You know, this is what they are passionate about. It is what they find rewarding, you know, and in that reward, you obviously are getting something out of it. There's no such thing, in my opinion, as pure altruism, because you always feel good about yourself if you do something nice. But they're doing it just for that. You know, they're doing it just because they're passionate about that environment. They love this place that they've grown up in. Almost all of them are from the region. And it's a place that they feel like should have protectors. And they're protecting the environment as well as the people, because they don't want their town to be thought of as a death trap. They want their town to be thought of as the place that they love. And so they're doing this purely for good reasons. And that's something to me that's inspiring. And I hope that it you know, in watching it, the audience can be reminded of what it means to be a good person and what it means to make decisions just purely based on helping others and helping the people and the environment around you.
We started today with Norman Lear, one of the great innovators in television history. And when he was getting going in the 1950s and early 60s, there were a number of shows that all in part dealt with the theme of rescues, whether it was Waterfront, Sea Hunt with Lloyd Bridges, Rescue 8, Whirlybirds, which was a syndicated show, Ripcord, all of this had dealing with the idea of rescuing people from different situations and hazards one way or another. Do you think possibly that at some point Red Bull TV could do a scripted show about that? Because we haven't had really maybe a little bit, I don't know, like an emergency or maybe a short-lived show every few years, but we haven't really had in a long while a scripted show dealing with the idea of rescuing people and what we could learn from in terms of how we protect ourselves, keep ourselves safe in the when sudden incidents happen. Has there any thought at Red Bull about perhaps taking what you did with the horn and maybe doing a scripted show at some point?
Yeah, it's something that's definitely possible. We've had discussions about working on some scripted projects, not this one specifically, although I do like the idea. You know, when we approach these things, we're really looking at the opportunity that's in front of us. And you know, Red Bull's ethos is, you know, that we give wings to people and ideas, and that we're always doing something beyond the ordinary and pushing limits. And so we saw the opportunity in what these people did to tell a story that fit very closely with our brand and our network's image and approach to life. And so, you know, kind of deriving from that, what we could do with a scripted series, it would be an incredible opportunity to tell that story. You know, there are shows that have been out that deal with, you know, obviously there are all the procedurals and the hospital shows and things of that nature that have similar themes, but they're all approached from, I mean, the hospital shows are mostly about interpersonal relationships amongst the doctors, right? So if it's really about what it means to be somebody who's out there on the edges doing what they can
And certainly there's the technology now, like GoPros and body cams and dash cams and so forth, to make it happen. We just lost Josh Cole. Josh, you can call back very quickly. We'll get you back on. But let's tell you that the program is The Horn, and you can find it on Red Bull TV, available 24/7 on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. So if you've got a smart TV set or a device, check to see if Red Bull TV is in your lineup. For more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.redbull.tv.thehorn, redbull.tv/thehorn. And Josh, I was just saying that, again, we let everybody know where the thing was going to be at, but if you had a thought to finish, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and thank you, Simon. Sorry, I got disconnected. This is what I get for working for Red Bull and being up in the mountains. So the hope would be to be able to tell a story like this where we could really focus on that drive and on that desire, you know, because it is just it's a story about passion, and it's a story about humans. And that's what I wanted to capture. It's what I wanted to edit, and it's what I wanted to present to the world. And I think we've all worked together, you know, from everybody internally at Red Bull to the partners we had at Original Media. You know, we've all worked really, really diligently to make sure that we told an honest story that everyone could relate to, no matter how old or young you are, no matter how much you care about going mountaineering or skiing. Everybody knows what it means to be a human, and we hope that this is something that our audience can really grab onto and learn from.
Once again, for more details online, www.redbull.tv/thehorn. www.redbull.tv/thehorn. The Horn available as part of Red Bull TV on smart TVs and smart TV devices. Josh Cole, executive producer, thank you again for joining. Congratulations to you and your production team. And more importantly, congratulations to the men and the women who are in that role of rescuing people, no matter what the situation is, for their courage, for their daring, and for their skill. We really appreciate you and what you've done to bring that experience and what they're up to, what they're causing for everyone in our lives. Hope that we will hear from you again soon. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, you too. Thanks so much, Simon. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Josh. Take care. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too.
Josh Cole joining us live from Idaho, California. Again, thank you to Norman Lear. Thank you to Joan Saltzman. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to all of you for a very special 90 minutes. Here on Tomorrow Be Televised. We are back on Monday, either at 3 or 3:30, with Julie Menon, the commissioner of the New York City Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up an episode you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version on iTunes.com, or if you have Apple TV 2.0, check out the Apple TV iTunes podcast app. If you don't have Apple TV, go to your local Apple store or order it online. No time, unfortunately, for our Clap Trivia Question of the Week, so we're going to keep it in play this weekend. If we don't get a winner by our next episode Monday, we'll keep it in play throughout the week. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think about what we had with Norman Lear and everyone else? And what's your thoughts on where TV is at and where it's going? We'd love to hear from you. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. And whatever you communicate with us, remember, what you say matters. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager, the creator of this very enterprise, Mr. Alan Levy. Tomorrow Be Televised is brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Company. But Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. We're back Monday, 3 or 3:30 p.m. Eastern, noon 12:30 Pacific. You know where, Blog Talk Radio. And please, be safe and be great out there. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.